I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We bathe in water, we drink it, we probably live around it or close to it. It flushes our toilets. We do so much with it, and it's such an important aspect of our lives, but we waste it, we take it for granted, and we certainly don't think about it as my next guest does. She has pondered water in an interesting, fascinating way. The title of the book is Water Is, and its author Nina Muntiano joins me now. She has spent a career as a limnologist and ecologist and has conducted research, published papers, and consulted in the environment. She's also immersed well enough in water to tell us about how we should think about it, and the way she goes about it in this book is awfully good in that she looks at water spiritually, artistically, and mythologically as well. Nina Muntiano is an award-winning novelist and short story writer as well, and currently teaches writing at the University of Toronto and George Brown College. The website for more is at meaningofwater.com. The book is published by Pixel Press. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Toronto today, Nina Muntiano. Ms. Muntiano, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Excellent.
So how would you, I tried describing the book in the introduction, but I guess since you're the author, it would probably be a good chance for you to tell us how you view this book and how you would describe it.
Yeah, I each time I describe it, I probably describe it differently because it's so, it is rather massive. It's bigger than even my fantasy novels, which is saying a lot. It's, 570-odd pages and essentially many books in one. To say it briefly, it's basically a meditation on water, and it asks the question what water means to any particular individual, and that goes from anything from religious, its sacred use, to its life-giving properties, and that also includes its weird properties and all the cool things about water. The fact that it is still a mystery to water scientists currently who are studying it. And it's such a common substance that nobody really knows how to tie down. It has at least 27 anomalous properties. And I love D.H. Lawrence back in, what was the day that he lived in, the 1800s?
Mm-hmm.
And his quote is, water is H2O, hydrogen two parts, oxygen one, but there is also a third thing that makes it water, and nobody knows what it is.
Mm.
And that's sort of the basis of it. What is it to you? What does it mean to you? And it's an attempt to help us connect with it, with this precious substance.
And just in terms of the numbers, it makes up how much of this the planet Earth? I mean, the percentage is quite large, right?
It is. It's
yeah.
It's interesting, too, that it's about 70-75% of makes up the surface of the planet, which, interestingly enough, is also the percentage that it makes up in humanity and humans and most living things, although that varies a fair bit. But it's almost like a fractal-type relationship going on with life and the planet and everything else that's going on.
Yeah, you mentioned that it is a massive book and that it is. One learns so much because you not only talk about it in terms of the spiritual and the mythological, but you know, the scientific as well, because that was your racket for a while.
Yeah.
So in terms of who the book's for, I mean, kids can pick this up too, can't they?
Sure.
It's
for anyone who, and I'm not even going to say who is environmentally conscious or inquisitive. In fact, it's perhaps more that. It's anyone who's human should get something out of it, because it spans such a range of topics and things of interest that water touches on, because water is in fact infused in everything, and particularly symbolically, historically, has acted as a metaphor, as archetype to all sorts of things, particularly in story. So that anybody flipping through it will find something of interest and hopefully connect in some way. I had someone tell me, a good friend, he said, I know what this book is. It's a cottage book. And what he meant by that is it's a book that you bring to your cottage, if you have a summer cottage, and just place on a table, and anybody can flip through it and find something really interesting to read. It's that sort of book that you don't necessarily read from cover to cover, even though you could. You could go from chapter to chapter, literally, but you can also just flip and find something of interest.
The other thing that struck me in reading your book was because it makes up so much of our planet, of ourselves, and we don't understand it as we should. Did you think that comes from, I was flipping through it, and you know, I see, you know, there's quotes from people, you know, everyone from Huxley and Van Gogh and
yeah.
And it's I guess the mystery of it, I guess, scares us. And so that's why we choose not to think about it as we should.
I guess there's that. It's interesting. I was just at a conference on where we touched on climate change, and that was sort of the consensus there, is that it's just too big and too mysterious for us to get a handle on. Therefore, we kind of ignore it.
Yeah.
I think with water, there's an added part, and that's that it's so common, and we just use it. And we do take it for granted in our nation, in Canada, which holds at least a fifth of the water on the planet. And we are the number one country for wetlands. The highest percentage of wetlands exists in Canada. So we turn the tap on, and there it is, right? And it's a common substance that doesn't, in fact, it has no color, has no taste. It's almost like an altruistic entity that we ignore. It's good for us, but there you go.
Yeah.
The other part of that is the mystery part is still not solvable, and that is truly mysterious. Water is sticky, for instance. Molecules stick to things, especially each other, which is what gives water its high surface tension, more so than any other liquid. And it also keeps you alive. It's what allows water to be pulled up along blood, you know, the narrow vessels, pulls the blood along the narrow vessels of the body, the capillary action in trees against the force of gravity. It also allows water to be a gas at room temperature because the water tension holds the molecules together like a sphere, like a drop. So it's got all these weird properties. Hot water, for instance, freezes faster than cold water. Did you know that?
No.
Nobody knows why.
Yeah.
And these scientists have been looking at this for years and years. It even has a name. It's called, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, the MEMBA effect. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
Water exists in many different phases. Like we have gas, liquid, and solid, and we can have those three phases all in the same place, pretty much, right? In your glass of water with ice in it,
yeah.
And the water vapor is around you, although you're not aware of it. Apparently, there's a fourth phase. Gerald Pollack over at the University of Washington has suggested that there is a fourth phase between the solid and the liquid. It's sort of the liquid crystal, and it's a different way that water binds together. And again, that harkens back to one of the reasons why water is different or weird, is that its structure, even though it's H2O, everyone goes, well, water's just water, right?
Yeah.
Water's two hydrogen and one oxygen. But it's how that water structures itself that creates these, what I call magical properties, and I devote one chapter to a lot of them.
Well, one of the parts in the book that I must admit, it interested me, but I was getting lost in the weeds, if you will, was this idea of the quantum properties of water,
right.
and how scientists today, there isn't a consensus among scientists today about that, and I guess the question to you is what do we need to know about water's possibilities, and I mean, can it store information as has been suggested by someone in your book?
Yeah, definitely. Many have. And that's one of the discussions that's currently ongoing and real debate between traditional scientists and other scientists who are willing to go outside the bounds there, that water has quantum properties like coherence and self-organization, and uses epitaxy, which is like mimicry, to create memory. It all comes down to how we define those things, too. How do we define memory? How do we define coherence and entanglement as well? It's a lot of schmozzy stuff to do with quantum mechanics, which most people don't really understand very well, myself included. I've researched a lot, and I understand it to some level to be able to see the logic of it.
Yeah.
But it's still quite mysterious, and as a result, the ongoing debate is still there. So it comes down to, in some cases, how we're willing to define memory. Memory is interesting because it isn't necessarily memory the way you and I think of memory. Mm-hmm. Like I remember when I was 4 years old. It's really a substance remembering, quote unquote, remembering its position before. And a lot of physical things that are going on, like elasticity and such, are based on this kind of memory. Cloud seeding, for instance, is based on memory per se. It's the Chinese are really good at this, right? They send up a substance that then attracts water, and water essentially acts like that substance, and then it creates the heaviness in the cloud and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then water forms. There's a lot of that kind of stuff going on. So how do you define memory in terms of, or intelligence even, is all sort of being discussed. So that's part of the debate, is that some people disagree with others on the definition of what these things are.
I guess it's more practical uses or how it affects our lives day to day. I mean, we've talked about for years how much water we waste. I mean, even when we're brushing our teeth, a lot of us, you know, have kept the tap on,
right,
while we're doing that, and
yeah,
we're dissuaded from doing that. And I must admit, I've stopped doing that, but only recently, because
yeah,
I just realized how much water I was wasting.
How much we waste.
Yeah.
I don't have the figures in front of me, but it's amazing how much a dripping tap can do, or just flushing the toilet with that amount of volume of each time you're doing it, how it all accumulates.
Yeah.
And you contrast that to the water scarcity in the world that's becoming, in fact, rather alarming in some cases. I mean, we use, I guess, here's a figure. Canadians use about 4,000 liters of water per day. And really, all that's really needed is 5 liters to survive. 5 liters a day. So currently, 80% of the world is living in an area where there's a threat to water security. That's huge.
Yeah.
And it's going to be much larger. So there we are, kind of, we're profligate. We're wasting it away. We have so much of it. That's the thing.
And so we've also, you know, a lot of us, and I must admit I'm one of these people that do this, and that's consume bottled water, and we shouldn't.
Yeah.
We tend to think that it's a lot cleaner than, say, tap water, but
it's not.
Yeah.
And in fact, in many cases, it has been proven to be tap water.
Hmm.
And not even a couple of companies have finally fessed up that it is tap water, and then they'll say, well, okay, but it's tap water, but we filtered it even more to make it cleaner. But in fact, if in an area like where I'm living currently, Toronto and Vancouver for sure, you don't need to do anything to your tap water. So
yeah,
why would you drink the bottled water? It's a real issue in terms of what it suggests, too. People who buy bottled water are essentially implying that they're not relying on tap water. And by doing that, they're making that a secondary source of water. And it's a public, what's the word, privilege. It's more than a privilege. Public, can't think of the word. something that everybody should have.
A right, yeah.
A public right.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And by choosing to commodify water, by buying it as a bottle, is taking the onus away from making sure that you provide that everybody has clean water to drink and do whatever they need to in their household. I mean, this brings to mind what's going on in Detroit and or various other places, not just Detroit.
Yeah, Flint, yeah.
The whole idea of commodifying water is essentially becoming more and more of an issue. If you look at places where there's water scarcity and drought happening, there's California as an example, where water wars are occurring as a result of allocation and taking water from one place, diverting it to another to fill somebody's swimming pool, right? Taking it away from, let's say, Owens Valley down in California as an example. In Colorado, the collection of rainwater is illegal. And this is because the water doesn't belong to that person, presumably, who's collecting the water. It belongs to everybody else, essentially. But then how does that translate, right? So effectively what the government is trying to do is keep people from hoarding water. And that's, again, that's problematic. That's suggesting that water doesn't belong to, isn't a public right. And when that starts to happen, we get more insidious things going on. What some of the bottling companies were doing and are still doing are going into watersheds and getting water for nothing. They're going in and mining the groundwater. They're getting it for nothing. Then they're putting it in a bottle and they're selling it.
Yeah.
And that water that's in that watershed that's collecting belongs to the community. And what's happening is they're losing their water. The groundwater aquifer is being dried up. They can't use it to water their crops, etc., and exist the way they need to within the watershed, because that water is being taken and sent to another country, like Pakistan or whatever, and sold to the people who can afford to buy it. It's quite bizarre.
Yeah, we had that in Vancouver here last summer when we were short of water, or there were heavy restrictions in terms of water use in this part of the world. And Nestle was getting water from the reservoir, I guess.
Yeah, that's the main company that I'm referring to.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're so big, though, that it's really hard to stop them. Communities have taken them to court, and a few of them have won. It's really hard to see what they're doing. They're doing some not so nice things in Pakistan as well. I mentioned Pakistan is ironically one of the countries with water shortage, and they are mining their water and then selling it to them. And these are people who can't afford to buy water. They should, you know, they really should have their own water for free. And yet, through the commodification and the allowance for that, water is turning into a commodity. That's a very serious issue.
So how does that stop then, Nina?
How does it stop? We, Maud Barlow with Council of Canadians is doing awesome things. Awesome things. And even so, I mean, that's one person, that's one group. But the Council of Canadians is an awesome group. And one thing we can do is donate to them, for one thing, and help out with them with the projects that they have. As an individual, just stop buying bottled water is a good thing. And let other people know why you've stopped. And if you need to carry water, we want convenience, right? Mm-hmm. So many of us do that. Just carry it. Grab something, a container. Make sure it's not a plastic bottle so you're not giving the wrong impression.
Mm-hmm.
And carry your water that way, like, you know, like a lot of people are doing. But making known why you do something, I think, is just as important as actually doing it. And I think a lot of people just don't realize what the ramifications are of those types of activities.
You mentioned earlier the amount of people in the world who don't have access to clean water, and it is a staggering figure in 2016 to think that there are people on this planet who can't get clean water.
Yeah, and they walk for miles and miles to get clean water. And sometimes that water isn't necessarily, in fact, in many cases, it's not guaranteed that it's clean.
Yeah. 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 And so I mean, I guess if we turn off the tap while we're brushing our teeth, if we stop buying bottled water, if we do these things to conserve water in our part of the world, do those things obviously do help elsewhere, right?
It's important for individuals to be able to do things like that, because otherwise we feel, literally again, to go back to that initial argument that we were talking about, then we feel like we're just one person in a giant sea and we're not doing anything and we're not having an effect, when in fact as individuals we have a great deal of power as individuals, and we just need to, again, like I said, let people know. But most importantly, it's for an individual to feel like they are making a difference by doing an individual action is important, because it then engenders further action. And it is at the individual level, at the ground root level, that things do happen. That's important to know. So these little things, they may be little things, but they're important things. And they're at the level of lifestyle that is actually what makes the biggest difference.
So you're a limnologist and an ecologist. How much of the work that you did studying water was informed by, say, water and its place in religion or in the spiritual, in mythology even? I mean, did that inform your knowledge of water?
When I was working as a limnologist, it didn't.
No.
I had a different view about everything when I was working as a scientist. Traditional scientist in those 20 years prior to, you know, fairly recently, I guess. I had a more pragmatic idea of what was going on, and I was studying a lot of times. I was working for an environmental consulting firm, and we were looking at pollution, and we did studies for clients like pulp mills and mining companies, and we looked at the impacts that they made on water. So my understanding and my focus was more utilitarian and more resource-oriented. And then when I started researching, what was before I started researching this book, but particularly when I started researching for the book, and this book incidentally took me longer to write than anything in the past has for that reason, I realized just how much water is still, and certainly was important to me on all those other levels, spiritually, philosophically, just the feeling of well-being. And the more I uncovered, the more I realized that most of the important events in my life, the people that I'd met, that I'd spoken to and had influenced me, had some relationship with water, funnily enough.
Uh-huh.
Right down from when I was a child, having the we grew up in Romanian Orthodox church, and the priest would come and bless the house by sprinkling water around, and I felt that the significance without really understanding what it was all about, holy water, for instance, and then going on and on, playing in the creeks with my brother and sister and creating potions out of water and, you know, with various other things and just playing with water and being totally immersed in, metaphorically as well as literally, the moving of water, the vortex shapes, not unlike what Da Vinci did. He spent hours and hours studying the eddy formation, vortexes in water, and he understood that this movement was very important, and in fact mimicked the Fibonacci spiral, and again, it has ties to sacred sacred shapes and the Platonic solids, even that sort of thing. So all these connections with ancient civilizations and religions and spiritual teachings seem to all have this common thread with water. And in the story that all of humanity has with water, very much mimics the hero's journey, which I teach in storytelling, the separation, the transformation, and the return. And that is very much the story of humanity with water, because without water, humanity wouldn't have existed. So we started, we formed our civilizations near water bodies, mostly rivers, and proceeded from there. And I tell that story in one of my chapters. In fact, water is a story.
Mm.
And learning these things connected me even more so, and I just had so many of these aha moments. It was quite a wonderful experience.
Yeah, and because we treat our oceans so badly, a point in the book that I'd like to bring up is this idea that we need, every organism needs to I guess take the ocean with it. That was the line I scrawled on my notes here.
Yeah.
That our inner fluids are like an ocean.
Very much. Exactly the inner ocean.
And so I think if we realized that, we would probably treat our oceans a lot better than we do.
For sure. I'm really hoping that those things will get pinged. And to that end, why do we feel so good when we go to the ocean, or any water body, for that matter, that's moving?
Right.
I constantly get, I write about this in the book, but I'm always getting people agreeing. They're saying, yes, this is where I want to always be. This is where I go to refresh myself. This is where I would prefer to live. In fact, Carl Jung said that.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you? Some of it is scientifically proven, and other things are more aesthetic, like the look and feel and the smell and the senses that you have, the form. But there's also the negative ions that moving water produces that gives us a feeling of well-being. And it's scientific in that the negative ions that are produced, actually what they do is they bind to positive particles, which tend to be dust, pollen, and those types of things, and basically knock them out of the air. So we have that sense, that refreshing sense. Part of that is from the negative ions that are produced. And just to give you some figures, a forest and a seashore provides anywhere, somewhere in the neighborhood of 50,000 negative ions per cubic centimeter. Niagara Falls, 30 to 100,000. A city freeway will contain 100 in comparison. And in fact, in rooms where you have air conditioners or electrical equipment, carpets, upholstery, and other synthetic materials, all of which actually produce positive ions, you're going to possibly even get, no more negative ions at all.
Hmm.
And again, that you can intuitively sense that, we're talking about offices, right? Mostly offices and apartment buildings.
Yeah.
And if you really want to get a refresher, that's what most people will say, go outside.
Right.
And part of that is just getting away from that positive ion environment and getting out where you're getting into the negative ions.
Now, you've written this book, and you've obviously thought about water and studied it for a while now, even before writing this book. Are there still questions that you have about water?
Yeah. And one of the frustrating things about writing this book is finishing it and getting it out, because then I'm constantly finding things, and I was finding all kinds of really cool things like that were important, that needed to go into the book, that were relevant, right at the last minute of, writing the book. And like George Lucas says, at some point you just have to stop. And you just sort of, he called it abandoning the project. I don't like to use that word, but you just have to truncate it and get it out. obviously there's more and more being found about water and questions that I still have that, you know, may take a while before they're answered. And that's fine. The questions are there. And I think maybe that's even the most important part, is to have, to connect through this book so that more people are asking questions, because there's nothing wrong with questions.
Yeah, I mean, I learned a great deal reading Water Is, but while reading it and after reading it, I'm still thinking about things, about how it affects my own life. And so I guess that's...
Actually, that's great.
Yeah, I think that's why you wrote the book, isn't it? To inspire that.
In fact, that's why it has the title it has.
Yeah.
And the dots at the end, right? Water is dot, dot, dot. And even though I answer, to some degree, each of the chapters, like water is magic, water is joy, water is wisdom, there are so many other things that water could be to you and to anyone else. And it's an ongoing dialogue, an ongoing discussion that I'm hoping that's what this book will engender, is an ongoing conversation.
Yeah, it's a great start. Yeah, it's a fine achievement and one to be proud of. It's been a pleasure speaking to you today.
And you.
And congratulations, Nina, and good luck with the book.
Thank you, Joseph.
You're very welcome. The book is called Water Is. It's from Pixel Press. That's the publisher. Nina Montiano joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.